This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Wilkin & Company, PC, Certified Public Accountants, helping businesses, individuals, and nonprofit organizations make financial decisions based on their personal values since 1987. Wilkin & Company is located at 2435 Southwest 5th Avenue in Portland. Information at 503-225-1359 or WilkinCPAS.com.
Good morning and welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. The storm surge generated by Hurricane Sandy, flooding significant areas across greater New York and New Jersey, demonstrated that the specter of climate change and the disasters it will wreak are now upon us. As the Northeast engages in a slow recovery from the storm's damage, a debate is now raging about how to prevent similar destruction from the inevitable next superstorm. This morning, we're talking about the impacts of a climate change future in which storms such as Sandy are becoming the norm. We'll discuss what it will take to build communities that are more resilient to the ravages of extreme weather events in a warming world with Todd Sanford, a climate scientist with the Climate and Energy Program at the Union of Concerned Scientists. Todd, welcome to Locus Focus.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
Well, it's good to have you. And this morning, I was just reading an article about a new study that's come out from a newly formed commission set up by Governor Cuomo in New York that's recommending all kinds of major changes in New York to deal with the next inevitable storm. I was wondering if you've gotten to see this report yet.
No, I've not yet.
Well, some of the things that we were discussing on the phone the other day, ranging from floodgates on the Narrows heading into New York Harbor to recreating sand dunes and oyster beds along the New York shoreline. So I'm wondering if, as a setup, what do you see are some of the lessons that these commissions and perhaps more forceful methods of actually enacting things, what things do you think that people in the Northeast should be looking at to prepare themselves for what's becoming inevitable?
Well, I think, first of all, that, you know, as you mentioned Sandy, I don't want to belittle it, but in some ways it provided a test case to really ask some questions which you brought up, that are we prepared for these type of events? And I think many of the answers in this case is no, we aren't. But also recognizing that, you know, under ongoing climate change, the projections are that, you know, the risks of these sorts of extreme events and the impacts that come along with them, such as flooding and heat impacts, are only likely to increase in the future. So it's not only enough to ask, are we prepared for what we have been facing? But it's also a question of, are we prepared for increasing risk as we go forward? So I think the commissions, you know, such as these, I think it's a good first step to really ask some questions about what were the impacts, how did we deal with them, where are the deficiencies? But sort of where the climate science side comes in is to realize that looking out not only next year but decades down the road, are we prepared for these risks as they keep increasing? And I think those sorts of questions probably aren't asked nearly enough.
Well, I know that one of your specialties is sea level rise. And there were some discussions right after Sandy about how, well, the reason why the storm was so bad was it was a high tide.
Right.
But what made that high tide different from high tides of maybe 50 to 100 years ago?
Well, I think the primary difference is, as you mentioned, the sea level rise, that you know, we're still going to have high tides, we're still going to have full moons, we're still going to have coastal storms. But the difference is that all of these sort of natural factors that we've always dealt with are now riding on increased sea levels due to climate change. So that's a new but ongoing and growing risk factor that needs to be included. So that was the primary difference in this case.
So what is perhaps wrong with the New York and New Jersey coastlines that makes them so vulnerable to major storms and the kinds of storm surges that can come in? I know that after Hurricane Katrina, there was a lot of talk about how the barrier islands, basically, and all the barrier protections in the Gulf Coast have been destroyed
right.
as part of industrial development. Is there an analogy along the northeast of a coastline that was once much better prepared to be resilient for superstorms?
Well, I think you mentioned barrier islands, and natural defenses are very important. So I think you mentioned that, or I read a New Yorker article that just came out that one of the propositions is to, basically improve wetlands in the area, oyster bed planting, so making use of natural defenses that we have. But I think that, you know, the East Coast in particular was so vulnerable because there are a lot of people and a lot of built structures in harm's way that, you know, the Pacific Coast luckily doesn't have to deal with, these sorts of storms very often. The East Coast is very prone to it. And I saw something, a statistic that something like over 37 million people, 12% of the nation's population, live in the coastal areas that are prone to these storms from North Carolina to Texas. So we just have a lot of people that are living close to the coastlines that are naturally in harm's way.
Well, I think another thing that really struck struck me as a former Northeasterner myself, mm-hmm. that it was one thing to be watching what was going on with New Orleans during right. Katrina, and that was shocking, and I've been to New Orleans once before, and I had felt a lot of compassion. I have friends in New Orleans. But I didn't imagine it in exactly the same visceral way as I did when I started seeing images of New York and New Jersey flooding.
Right.
And, in fact, the other day I was reading that they're taking down the boardwalk in Long Beach, and that kind of struck me because that was a place I hung out with when I was a kid. And
yeah.
So these are things where when it's your memories, your connections to your life, it has more impact. And so I have two thoughts about that I wanted to ask you about. One is that there's so many people in the Northeast compared to any other part of the United States that I wonder if that all those memories and all those emotional responses and familiarity have a greater impact than when we have flooding in less populated areas. And the other part is that connection. What does it mean, or what does it take for us to feel compassion for people who are going through these kinds of disasters, and what does it take for us to recognize that this could happen to us?
Well, I think both of the answers, feeling compassion and the recognition, unfortunately, probably in many cases, take actually experiencing it yourself. For instance, my personal story, which very much pales in comparison to what others are facing, but I, you know, my house was flooded in one of the tropical storms a couple years ago, and that was the first time I'd really experienced, you know, a serious impact from weather. So all these issues and photos that you see on TV and in magazines, it really brought that home for me personally, although luckily I wasn't, you know, personally harmed in any way. But, you know, I think that's a commentary on the broader climate story that, you know, 2012 was really a remarkable year for extreme weather. And I think that's why you're hearing, you know, folks like Mayor Bloomberg really talking about climate in the context of extreme weather a lot more often, because now they've experienced it. Mayor Bloomberg's city has been hit by it. So it's really brought something, you know, climate change writ large, that maybe was really far removed and abstract, like changes in the Arctic, to something that everyone potentially can experience, and that's through the impacts of extreme weather. And I think that's why we're seeing a change in the conversation somewhat around this.
There's also a corollary to that. I'm thinking, I mean, I had my own personal flooding experience about 4 years ago, and actually had nothing to do with a tropical storm. It had to do with a faulty irrigation system that flooded our basement,
but
which
still
is
a flood.
Was that?
But still a flood.
Still a flood. And yeah. But this was in 2008, and it was a finished basement with it was carpeted and it had wallboard, and so it was a sort of a difficult thing to deal with. It was basically
right.
Having your living space flooded.
Yep.
But because I had been following so closely what had been going on in New Orleans in the wake of Hurricane Katrina, I was very aware of dangers like mold. And so we wind up taking care of it and discovering, of course, there was black mold that was forming in places, and we had to do an awful lot of remedial stuff. But I don't think I would have thought that it was such a serious thing if my awareness hadn't been heightened by Hurricane Katrina. So I wonder if those people who aren't living in a place that's already been devastated maybe are starting to pick up some lessons about their own need for preparedness.
I would hope so. And again, you know, just to trade personal stories here, with my flooding, I unfortunately did not pick up on the lessons from Katrina. And, you know, Union of Concerned Scientists, we produced a report a year or so ago on the hidden health risks of flooding. And this was just after my flooding that I experienced. So I really was not aware of the risks. And, you know, as you mentioned, the mold, that's a serious issue, can exacerbate things like asthma. Even simple things, like I didn't have an appreciation of how risky it is to drive through flooding. That there, we found a stat that, you know, the people killed in the U.S. in floods in 2010, 44% died in their vehicles. And, you know, things like that, you know, basically sewage issues that you need to be aware of. So there's, yes, I definitely agree with you that heightened awareness is a critical part of, you know, managing these sorts of impacts that we're dealing with. And I think one of the things we can do is really get the message out there about not only for flooding, but for extreme heat and drought and all these other types of events. You know, basically what sorts of risks are we facing and how can we reduce those risks, and what are the support services out there for us? So I think it's a big information campaign that needs to happen as well. And I like to think of myself as pretty aware, but in the case of flooding, I definitely was not. So I can only imagine that there are many other millions of people out there who just really don't have an appreciation for it and how serious it can actually be.
Well, we're talking this morning with Tom Sanford, who is with the Climate and Energy Program at the Union of Concerned Scientists, and we're talking about some of the lessons that we're learning from Superstorm Sandy, which struck on the East Coast at the end of October of last year, and how this is probably a lot more relevant to a lot of other parts of the country than maybe we want to think about. Let's talk a little bit more about sea level rise. I was just looking at an article yesterday that was new projections are that by 2100, the seas may have risen by as much as 3 feet. And, of course, that's a long time away from now, right?
Sure.
So we think. But, of course, there was a time when we thought the year 2000 was a long time away
that's
as well.
Right.
So time does progress. And so there's a couple of questions. One is, what does that mean, three feet of sea level rise? And what does that imply about the incremental rises between now and 2100?
Well, you know, like, unfortunately with climate, small numbers, you know, that may be easily dismissed can actually end up meaning a lot when you think about global impacts. So sea level rise of 3 feet, it doesn't sound like a lot, but actually, you know, you're getting into losing a lot of populated coastline when you get into those sorts of numbers. So you rightfully mentioned that, you know, another thing is that there are often long, you know, time frames put to these numbers. So, you know, in the year 2100. But if you think about, you know, the potential need to relocate large populated areas or some of the, you know, a lot of the costly infrastructure, then you're talking about, you know, planning and funding for that that needs very long lead times. So, you know, while that's very far, 2100 is very far removed from the next election cycle, I think it is worthwhile to start thinking longer term because, you know, unlike weather, which fluctuates day to day and season to season and year to year, I mean, with climate, we're talking about the longer term trend. So I think it's very fair to start looking, you know, decades out and asking some serious questions about planning and infrastructure and, you know, needing to make choices today, or at least get those started.
Well, I know that there's a lot of discussion about many different ways of talking. One of the phrases I find kind of interesting is hardening the city infrastructure. And it can mean anything from these floodgates they're thinking of putting in the New York Narrows to making the electrical system, the other utilities, more resilient to to flooding and not breaking down. And one interesting one is to have the electrical grid be not just a kind of large-scale grid, but have also autonomous stations that would be independent. So it would be kind of a hybrid system. And it gives an example to me about how, as we've made everything on a much larger scale and serve much wider areas, that we've lost our autonomy, whether it's being able to provide electricity, being able to provide food. So I'm wondering if you have thoughts about what it would take, what a more resilient community would look like in the face of climate change and particularly in the face of dealing with heavy storms. How would the infrastructure change and how would maybe our communications and our just social systems be different?
Right. Well, you know, I think you mentioned it, that you sort of alluded to having smart grids. So basically, I think it's termed islands, so that if you have these island areas that you can sort of, maybe, you know, I guess one way I think about it is if you've seen any submarine movies, you know, like World War II movies or whatever, if a compartment gets flooded, they have ways to shut it off so you don't get cascading flooding throughout the sub. So I think these islands, as I think they're called, setting up the system that way so when, you know, there is a big event coming your way, you can sort of localize, you know, the power systems, for instance, so that you don't get, you know, basically a domino effect where they're all still, you know, heavily connected to one another. And if you lose one, it's sort of, you know, just the dominoes fall all throughout. And also with so there's that aspect of the built resilience. And I think part of that also gets into, you know, I was mentioning about needing to look further down the road and what we're facing, that, you know, as we're investing in maybe some of these built solutions, we need to really ask, well, are they only good for, you know, what we're likely facing the next 10 years? Are they good out to 50 years or 100 years? And also, can we improve them if need be? So, you know, are they easily added to down the road if the, you know, whatever risk, a flooding risk or whatever, increases more than we plan for? But also with building resilience, I think there's, you know, a lot of these built solutions, they often take a long time to get going. They cost a lot up front, although I would argue that's money well invested. But there's also a community system and this a community resilience aspect. And this sort of gets back to what we were talking to earlier, is about just general awareness of the risks and effective communication within these communities. There was and I read about a study that looked at how different neighborhoods in Chicago responded to the heat wave in the 90s that they faced, and they found that the communities that fared better had, you know, very strong social networks and community organizations in place. So it's not just a built solution. There's also, you know, social and community solutions, too, that will help us be resilient.
Well, I just received a notice a few days ago from the city of Portland letting me know where my community gathering place and emergency center will be in case of an earthquake, which is a very serious concern here. So I know where to go now, where both be a communication system and also if I need to get out, if I can't be in my house, it would be where you'd go to find emergency housing and whatever. And I thought it was interesting to see that this is, I don't know how many earthquakes it's taken for Oregon to finally realize that we have to start getting these kind of preparations in place. Of course, there's a whole lot of other stuff that I don't think we're really dealing with on a personal level or on a community level. It's great that I know I can go to the middle school in my neighborhood if there's an earthquake, and that's going to be set up within 3 hours after the earthquake, which might not be soon enough. But there's all these other things in my house that are probably also serious concerns that I'm not taking, and I don't even quite know how to take the steps. So I wonder, how do we get this working both on a larger governmental system and also on the individual level?
Yeah, and so I think these sorts of conversations need to be happening at all these levels. So, you know, sort of the top-down approach, it's just, you know, the federal government and FEMA, I mean, ideally they could go into each community and be effective in providing responses and preparation, but the fact of the matter is, you know, they're stretched too thin as it is. So on some level, there's, you know, a responsibility for, at the community level, to have conversations with, you know, the health departments and the CDC. I'm sort of thinking more about health risks at this point, but it could be infrastructure as well. But really determining, you know, for any event, whether it's climate-related or not, you know, what sort of risks am I facing? What are my resources? You know, as you say, where's the nearest community center? So I think that it's a conversation that can be had at numerous levels, the very local, county, state, up to federal. But there are lessons to be learned at each level that are useful for everyone else. So I think communication is a big issue, to realize that this is a shared problem. You know, it's a shared risk that we're all facing, you know, some more than others. You know, for instance, in Portland, you're not dealing with hurricanes.
Oh, we have them occasionally, actually. They call them cyclones. But
yeah, but you're not quite as much at risk as, say, Florida is. But, you know, it's the same sort of conversation, assessing what sorts of risk we're facing, what resources we need, and, you know, really how to respond to it. And I think that's a conversation that's not, at some level it's going to be place-specific, but the overall topic of the conversation is one that, you know, we need to be having it at all levels.
Well, I mean, one place where I'm seeing it changing is along the Oregon coast, where they have a very highly developed tsunami warning system. And people, they actually have tsunami drills, and there's very good signage. Now, some people might not take it seriously, but I think the people, at least who spend a lot of time on the coast or who live there, are appreciating after the tsunami Indonesia a few years ago that this is something that is a serious issue on the west coast of the United States, as it is any place else along the Pacific. But it seems that that conversation is not happening on a whole lot of levels, and I wonder if it's happening on the East Coast now. Now, you're in Washington, D.C., which basically is in the same path of potential destruction that New York is in. Is there talk about having that kind of warning system and people preparing their own personal life skills that they need to cope with a kind of disaster like that?
I personally have not heard of that yet. I think we're still in the cleanup and response phase, that, you know, people are still trying to get back into their homes and make sure there's reliable power. So I don't think there's been quite enough distance from this particular event yet to start having these more forward-looking conversations. But I think it's definitely made it, you know, sort of prime the pump, so to speak, to have those conversations, that so many people were impacted by this. And, you know, the science is saying that for a number of reasons that this is a risk that's probably not going away. So I think it's just natural for people to start looking back and asking, you know, can I deal with this again? And I think the answer is probably going to be no. And, you know, what sorts of changes in planning do we need to put in place to address that?
Well, I was thinking about some of the systems that broke down in the New York, New Jersey, Southern Connecticut area, and it seems like it fell into a few areas. Most notably was electrical power.
Yeah.
And that was also very different depending on where you lived, whether you had power and how soon it came back. Another one was access to gasoline, that people couldn't get gas for their cars. Then, of course, there was the issue of food. And I wonder that wasn't actually like I talked about as much, but I know here in the Northwest, if we have weather disasters, the food on the shelves of grocery stores south of Portland along the I-5 corridor like starts to disappear really quickly because they don't have warehouses down there.
Oh, yeah, that was the case here.
Mm-hmm. And so I had the impression. So it seems like there needs to be some talk about how do we revitalize what used to be local food systems, because most of our food didn't used to come shipped from around the world. How would that strengthen resiliency in terms of disaster? Mm-hmm. We talked a little bit about the power, but I keep thinking about all the jokes about Long Island Power, but why was it that Long Island was for weeks without power, whereas Lower Manhattan got their power back pretty quickly? So there's some other forces at play, whether it's ineptitude, corruption, whatever. So how do we look at these problems, and how do we find, or is there a way perhaps to solve some of them by becoming more locally self-sufficient?
Yeah, I think so. I think... You know, again, this sort of gets back to maybe the island description of the systems that, you know, on some level there should be enough redundancies and independence in the systems where, it's not a big chain of dominoes going down, that you can have these local systems that are more resilient and not so dependent on others. So, you know, I think that's sort of the, and this could, you mentioned food, I know less about this, but, you know, that would fit in with, you know, these are valuable resources that we need, you know, power, clean drinking water, food, that, you know, it seems like the infrastructure in many cases currently is just not quite up to the task. And I saw a while ago, there was a 2009 report from the American Society of Civil Engineers, and it gave much of America's infrastructure a grade of D, and it said that it gave even worse ratings to infrastructure that's especially critical or vulnerable under a changing climate, such as levees, dams, you know, wastewater treatment, drinking water management. So currently in the U.S., I mean, I'm sure there are some exceptions to this, but I think overall, you know, our infrastructure to deal with these sorts of impacts just is not up to the task. So it's, again, it's a question that, you know, or a conversation we need to be having at all levels. So not only Portland, for instance, how resilient is that city in terms of its energy and water and food supply, but, you know, as a nation more generally, you know, again, this is, you know, extreme weather has always been with us, and it will continue to be with us. And, you know, a lot of the science is saying that many types are only going to, you know, perhaps increase in frequency or severity. So we've got some really tough infrastructure questions that we need to answer, or at least, you know, start the conversation about it.
I'm talking this morning with Todd Sanford, who is a climate scientist with the Climate and Energy Program at the Union of Concerned Scientists, and we're talking about some of the lessons learned from Hurricane Sandy and how it points to our need to really make our cities way more resilient for upcoming future superstorms. I have this image in my mind of these many, many photographs and film that I saw of all these flooded cars floating around in New Jersey and Lower Manhattan. And there's somebody said in the wake of the storm, people need to move their cars to higher ground before the storm hits. Of course, in New York, it's pretty hard to find parking. And it might be after that storm that higher ground parking is going to be a lot harder to find than it was before. But that said an awful lot to me, that there were the two images about like what really is vulnerable in our society in the wake of these kind of storms was all those cars floating around, and then the fact that there was oil and gas available. I mean, it was stored in places, but it couldn't get to the gas stations. And so there were those long gas lines for people whose cars weren't floating around in the flooded areas. So how do we counter that kind of, I mean, that sort of really defines the way our society runs right now. And what does it make us think about some of the problems there?
Well, you know, for me, just as you described it, I thought about the disconnect between, as you put it, people wanting to move their cars to higher ground, but maybe not themselves. So, you know, for me, it's asking more fundamental questions about, you know, where I live, and it, you know, maybe I shouldn't be worried just about my car, but, you know, is my house or my apartment really, is it prepared for, you know, impacts from flooding, for instance? So again, I think that just speaks to, you know, sort of this risk analysis that each of us have to deal with. So, you know, I was much more worried about my, you know, not having mold in my basement, for instance, or not being electrocuted when I went down there than, you know, having access to my car. And then as far as the you know, long gas lines, again, that just gets into sort of this, you know, the problem with moving resources to where they need to be in the, you know, under these extreme events, that we're seeing a big breakdown, that, you know, being without power for weeks, that just shouldn't happen. I think that we have the technology where we could make that something of the past, but, you know, for whatever reason, that hasn't happened yet.
Well, there's another issue I'm thinking in terms of how you successfully, quote, harden the infrastructure, particularly the utility infrastructure. Mm-hmm. And there's talk about, well, all the power outages on Long Island and a lot of them in New Jersey were due to trees coming down and taking down the power wires. That's a problem here in Oregon where we have pretty regular windstorms as well.
Right.
But in lower, so the idea is that you put all the electrical wiring and everything in conduits underground. Well, in New York, the problem was with the flooding, water got into all those tunnels where all the infrastructure was.
Yeah.
And so it shorted out that way, and there were generators and other things that were just destroyed by salt water. So is there a good place? What do you do with this infrastructure? You can't have it above ground, you can't have it below ground. What do we do with it?
Well, I'm not sure the direct answer to that, but again, I mentioned this recent article in the New Yorker, and they used Rotterdam and, you know, the Netherlands more broadly as examples of how, you know, a city and a country sort of becoming climate resilient in a smart way. And, you know, most of their energy lines, apparently, according to the article, they are underground, but they're in water-resistant pipes, so they're encased in pipes that you know, can't be flooded. So that's you know, sort of one answer to that.
And very expensive, too, it would seem.
Well, so that, yeah, and that gets into sort of the investment and planning side of things, that, you know, making our systems more resilient, yes, there is oftentimes a costly investment up front, but then you need to think about, you know, how much the impacts from Sandy cost. And, you know, potentially getting these more and more, you know, down the road, you know, some investment up front, if you do the full, you know, sort of cost-benefit analysis, I guess, seems to, you know, make a lot more sense when you look, you know, a year, 2 years, 5 years, 50 years down the road. So, you know, a lot of these areas, you know, including Rotterdam, have decided that they want to minimize their future risk and impacts, you know, by investing, you know, in these changes up front. So it's, you know, that's part of the discussion we've got to have is, you know, how much do we value impacts like Sandy down the road, you know, versus making some investments now? And well, that's a tough conversation to have, but, you know, there have been examples of other places around the world that are making those investments now.
Now, on the other extreme of this, I think that this recent event on the East Coast made a lot of people feel like they were living in the third world. And I was reading a response to your blog from November about Hurricane Sandy's toll on public health.
Mm-hmm.
And this woman writes, Doctors Without Borders has now set up clinics in the Rockaways. I don't think any of us expected to see this level of lacking access to health care, said Lucy Doyle, Dr. Lucy Doyle, who has served with Doctors Without Borders in the Democratic Republic of the Congo and Kenya, and says that working in Queens feels a lot like being in a field in a foreign country.
Right.
So what does that say to you about the fact that Doctors Without Borders had to set up offices, field clinics in Queens?
I mean, the quick answer is that tells me we're not where we need to be. That, you know, for the wealthiest country in the world to have those sorts of issues, it, you know, in my mind, it tells me that we need to be making investments in other areas where they're currently not getting funding. So, you know, to have that issue and you know, in the area around even the largest city in our country, to have those sorts of issues, it basically screams to me for, you know, we're not having the right conversations at this point, and we need to ask some much tougher questions than we are currently.
Well, one of the toughest questions that comes to my mind is going back to that article I read about the sea level rises of 3 feet by mm-hmm. 2100. What does it mean if we have to move New York, Washington, Boston, L.A., Honolulu, Seattle?
I don't know. And again, that would, you know, in my mind, that would sort of invoke the precautionary principle that I don't want to find out what that means. I, you know, sort of want to make the investments now you know, not only infrastructure, but mitigating the underlying problems, so doing something about climate change, since, you know, that's not the only thing driving the risk of experiencing these events, but it definitely is increasing it. So, you know, I don't want to know what it means to move New York City, but I would rather, you know, take on some perhaps easier problems to imagine at this point and find solutions for those so we don't have to go down that road at some point.
Well, I've given this a lot of thought. We are at the other end. In Portland, we are far enough inland, and we do live within tidal effects along the Columbia River, but I was told by somebody who knows that the tsunami will not hit us, so we're safe there, that sea level rise will not really affect us. Yep. Our climate's getting wetter instead of drier. It's getting a little bit milder and not so hot in the summer. So, you know, everything's getting better here. So everybody else in the country is going to come here. So that's one of the fears. But then on the other hand, there's this big concern about there being the big earthquake. And that's the place where my mind can't go there to really imagine what would happen if we had a 10.0 earthquake in Oregon. And it's going to happen sometime in the next 250 years. So when we can't go there, and we can't begin to imagine that level of disaster, is there a constructive way to, I mean, with earthquakes, it's a little different from climate change, so we can't do anything about that, which makes me maybe think why I really can't go there. But with climate change and thinking about these disasters, you talk about finding ways to mitigate beforehand. What are you thinking would be the steps that we can take so that we don't have to go to thinking about moving New York City?
Well, I think the quick, simple answer is to, you know, move towards a lower carbon energy economy. So, you know, really ramping up the deployment of renewables and also making investments in the research into them. You know, there are a lot of things we can do on personal levels about decisions we make for, you know, where we live, how close do we live to work, and, you know, modes of transportation. So things that seem little but can all add up. But, you know, fundamentally, the sorts of, you know, reductions in emissions, you know, scientists mention that we'll need to make, it's really going to need to be transformational in how we use energy. So a lot of this has to do with having these conversations. So really talking about what would it take to transform, you know, the way we use energy, but also folding in the impacts and adaptation discussions as well, because these are very related issues. So you can't just have we need to reduce carbon emissions by 80%, you know, to have any chance of stabilizing climate at a reasonable level, without asking, well, why are we having this conversation? And, you know, I think that's been brought to the fore this past year that, you know, part of the reason we are having this conversation is the types of events we're likely to face in the future. You know, we had a good snapshot of it this year. So I think it's multiple conversations that need to be had. So not only what can we do to mitigate the underlying problem, but recognizing that some degree of change is already here, and no matter what we do in the future, we're going to still experience some amount of change just due to the climate system itself. So, you know, do we have adaptation measures in place? Do we have enough information about all the impacts in place to be able to respond? So, it's, you know, we need to be having these conversations in parallel. But again, I think that you mentioned, you know, facing a big earthquake in Oregon and you know, I think it's important to at least, although it seems really far-fetched and something you don't want to talk about, you know, I think it still does make sense to at least ask some broad questions about, you know, down the road, what are we facing? How bad can it get? And are we at all prepared? I mean, one thing I fear, you know, that we're doing is going and heading into the future really blind in a lot of ways. So I think just increasing the information about what we're likely to be facing and then allows you to, you know, ask some really serious questions about what we need to be doing in the meantime.
Well, we've actually been having that conversation in Oregon about the earthquake, and I guess the general consensus is we're not prepared. So, and it's a really big deal to prepare for.
But that's a good piece of information to know that.
Right. I do know
you're not prepared can then allow you to have, you know, take some next steps towards getting there.
Yeah, I know there's one bridge in the area that actually would stand up to an 8 earthquake. It's very far away from downtown Portland, though. So, and it's kind of ironic that this is, it's the most recent bridge, but that they're starting now to rebuild bridges that are, and thinking in terms of at least having a Richter scale 8 earthquake that it can withstand.
Right.
Especially after the lessons of the Bay Bridge in 1989. Mm-hmm. Well, this has been very good things to think about today. And I'm just curious, are you also working on other aspects of climate change induced catastrophes like drought and wildfire? Are you mainly focusing on sea level rise and flooding?
Well, I mean, one area that we're moving into is we're starting to look at the impacts to the Intermountain West forests. So, you know, bark beetle outbreaks, for instance, and increased wildfire risk. And what are the connections to climate change there? It's something which, you know, I'm sure Oregonians care about as well, their forests. And what are the local impacts? You know, and this gets into all the services that forests provide for us. We're continuing to look at, you know, connections between climate and extreme weather. You know, there's stronger evidence for some than others. But also, I guess I would leave you and your listeners with, I don't want this to be strictly sort of a doom and gloom conversation, that, yes, we are facing some very severe impacts. We're already facing them and experiencing them. But, you know, a lot of the solutions that we're talking about, like smarter grid systems, you know, better public awareness on the risks, I mean, you know, these sort of innovative solutions in often cases provide multiple benefits. So, you know, I don't want this to be just about impacts, but as we're talking about the impacts and how to mitigate those, you know, we're able to be pretty creative and innovative in some new solutions that, you know, I think that's a positive outcome of this, that, you know, the solutions we're talking about can create jobs and provide multiple benefits, you know, beyond just mitigating, you know, impacts from extreme weather, for instance.
And make us all a whole lot healthier, too.
I think so, yeah. So there's a lot of wins to be had here.
Well, I want to thank you very much for joining us. We've been talking with Todd Sanford, who's with the Climate and Energy Program at the Union of Concerned Scientists, and I hope to have you back on. We can talk about some of the other aspects of climate change that you're working on sometime in the future.
Great. I'd be happy to. Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks a whole lot.
Okay, take care.
And you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed or you want your friends or family to hear this show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website. And for now, since our website's a little bit kafloofed at the moment, go to kboo.fm, and if you just do in the search engine, you can search for today's show, which is 1-7-2013 Locus Focus, and the program will come up. And if you want a cleaner version of the audio than what's on that, you can just, if you put audio in the search, you will sometime later on this afternoon be able to get a nice clean version of the show. Next week we'll be talking about the nanoparticles in our food with author Britta Belli. I'm Barbara Bernstein. My engineer is Carlos Chavez. And I want to thank you very much for listening, and Happy New Year.
KBOO is proud to be a media sponsor of An Evening with Dr. Michelle Alexander, Wednesday, January 16th, 2013, from 5 to 9 p.m. at Emmanuel Temple, located at 1033 North Sumner Street. Dr. Alexander is the author of The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Colorblindness. There will be a community fair, community panel, and Michelle will read from her book. For more info, go to kboo.fm.
Into the world I plunge, through my headphones, escaping to the streetlight. I begin to believe in destiny when my...
KBOO Radio is a proud media sponsor of the 28th annual Martin Luther King Day event. Keep Alive the Dream, an annual tribute to Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., produced by the World Arts Foundation. This year's event will take place at the New Beginnings Conference Center, 3300 Northeast 172nd Place in Portland. KABU will again broadcast the annual celebration in its entirety. More information about this live broadcast can be found at kabu.fm/2013MLK.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. Next up, we have a change in the schedule. The Health Watch program with pediatrician Lawrence Rosen has been canceled. Instead, we'll hear Food Sleuth Radio featuring an interview with Andy Fisher, former director of the Community Food Security Coalition, about how corporate America benefits from the food stamp program and the real advocacy that's needed to reduce poverty and corresponding hunger. At 11:30 on Madness Radio, speed skate champion Megan Buesen describes her ordeal with trauma and eating disorders and how her medications only made her worse. Thanks, KABU members, for your generous support in 2012. Best wishes in 2003.
Hi, welcome to Food Sleuth Radio, where we help you think beyond your plate. I'm Melinda Hemmelgarn, a registered dietitian and investigative nutritionist on a mission to connect the dots between food, health, and agriculture and find food truth. And today I'm honored to welcome Mr. Andy Fisher. He has truly been a catalyst in the good food movement since about the mid-90s. He was the co-founder and former executive director of the Community Food Security Coalition, and he had that role from 1994 to 2011. He is now writing a book. It's an important book about how our hunger community is so wedded to corporate America, and it's an important story that needs to be told. Andy, welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me, Melinda.
Andy, I need to ask you how you came to be interested in hunger.
Sure. I was a graduate student at UCLA in urban planning in 1992, and I was much more focused on environmental issues and environmental justice issues. And when the Rodney King civil disturbances happened in 1992 in Los Angeles, and it galvanized myself and a number of other students to look in our own backyard.